Hello, and we're continuing in the section of the synthesis of yoga called the Yoga of Divine Works. This chapter is the three modes of nature. We had somewhat convenient breakage in the argument. Sri Aurobindo, in his revision, gave us a rather short section for consideration tonight if we follow these asterisks. And so we thought we would take a moment just to go over a bit of the background of the three modes of nature and talk a little bit about the Sankhya system. I know it's a soporific. Do try to stay awake. The term Sankhya means enumeration, like counting the principles. In this case, counting the principles of nature. We know of Sankhya by legend in association with a great sage, Kapila, who may have lived as far back as 1300 BCE. His chief disciple was Asuri, and Panchashikha followed upon him and gave us our first look at what we would call proto-Sankhya, where the main teaching was simply this capacity to psychologically stand back from identification with the flow of natural phenomena. Several hundred years later, let's say around the time of the Gita, we begin to see a more systematized approach to Sankhya. This is around 500 BCE. And there is the enumeration, the description of the gunas who, in their intermixture, form everything that exists in the cosmos. Another few hundred years go by, and we have Patanjali of the Sankhya school, say around 200 CE. And then later still, Patanjali of the Yoga school, the one who is credited with pulling together the Yoga Sutras. So there's more than one Patanjali. In fact, there are a couple of others. There's one who's noted as a dancer. There's another one who's noted as a grammarian. Patanjali was a rather common name. They should not be conflated into one. But finally, we get to the classical Sankhya period, which came into being around 400 or 500 CE, the Common Era, the one that was developed by Ishvara Krishna into the scheme that we know, where there are 24 modes of nature. A 25th principle is the Purusha, if you want to count the Purusha, who watches nature. Now, as we said recently in the Upanishads, I think it's in the Chandogya Upanishad, there is a scheme in which nature is viewed as she who produces and uses the colors red, white, and black in the coordination of the cosmos. That sounds very much like the three modes of nature that are under discussion by Sri Aurobindo here, the three gunas. So the basic idea underlying the Sankhya system is that there is a root nature, mula prakriti. Prakriti, what creates, what is normal, what is all of our experience. There is no form that is not a creation of Prakriti. There is no sensation, there is no feeling, there is no thought which is not a form of Prakriti. Mula Prakriti is the root, the primordial mother of all things, you might say. Prakriti is the energy of that root nature, who then has within her three gunas, sattva, rajas, and tamas. Sattva is the principle of equilibrium, light, and balance. Rajas is a principle of energy and relentless movement. And tamas is a principle of darkness, obscurity, inertia, standing still. So if there's a Mula Prakriti who contains within herself the possibility of dynamic energy, it means that Mula Prakriti is herself not in motion. Prakriti is in motion, but only through the action of her three qualities, her gunas. So you see, there's several phases of cosmic activity encoded in this. There is no movement in Prakriti until there is the silent assent, the witnessing action of a Purusha, who is pure consciousness, sheer awareness, unformed. The Prakriti action that we see as cosmic is also true of the individual. And what is true of the individual connotes that it is also cosmic. So, the scheme as set forth looks like this. At the root of things is Mula Prakriti. Prakriti stands forward when the witness gaze, the sakshi, of the Purusha, the person, notices. It is as if the act of watching gives cause to nature's movement. And the first thing that happens in the combination of these gunas is the creation of a great consciousness, a mahat, a vast, which in some texts is also called buddhi, that which is illuminated, that which contains light. This becomes, in a sense, self-aware. Well, we can say that no consciousness is actually invested in Prakriti, but all awareness is a reflection of Purusha's own consciousness reflected into, projected into the movement of nature. So Mahat Buddhi has no consciousness of its own, but possesses in a way the reflected consciousness of the Purusha. That consciousness reflected in buddhi is then, in a sense, interpreted by a further evolution in Prakriti's movement of the ahamkara, the I-maker. Literally, aham means I, kara means maker, doer. So Prakriti has created an illumined agency which now becomes aware and says, I am. Because ahamkara comes into being, a number of other evolutes occur. There is first the creation of a sense mind, manas. The sense mind would deliver something to the ego sense, which would reflect upon it in the buddhi, if it had something to look at, but it does not. So it creates sensory organs, indriya, which are subtle, and then because they are subtle, need to substantiate themselves as the actual motor organs of things, and so have both subtle and objective classifications. Those motor organs, in a sense, extend themselves as the tanmatras, the subtle elements. Ah, yes, the subtle being comes into formation through this. And finally, there is the distillation of all of this chain of being into the bhutas, the gross objects. So you can see that prakriti begins with the most refined, subtle element, leading to the grossest. This is in a way assonant with the long tradition in India that the universe comes from above, not from below. That in the old image, the cosmic tree's roots exist there, up there, and extend the trunk, the branches, and the leaves below. This what we would call prakriti is an entirety. It's all that we experience. It is nature, but not nature which is at war with itself. The three gunas create impersonally. And so everything is within a context. When we separate Purusha from Prakriti, then we have a dualism. Then we have a division. When the Sankhya philosophy reaches a philosophic development where there's an insistence that Purusha is absolutely separate from Prakriti, that consciousness is abstracted out of nature, then we have division. Then, in a sense, we have war. And it's even reflected in the gender, because the Purusha is seen as being male. Prakriti is seen as being female. So this gendered approach to nature, as if nature has to be rejected if one wants freedom, if one wants liberation, becomes an unfortunate aspect of Indian philosophy throughout. It permits us to see nature as an enemy of enlightenment, as a means of allurement. So we have a fundamental schism. Nature can then become a commodity. Nature can then simply be a product that we use. for Sri Aurobindo, the division between Purusha and Prakriti is not absolute. The division is useful in early spiritual experience so that one can become aware of a sheer essential consciousness and stand back from all the play of phenomena and realize that one is essentially this. The essence of being is an awareness. But you'll see as we continue to read tonight that it is the ascent, the conscious volition of the Purusha working in Prakriti that authorizes all movement. It is when ascent is withdrawn that one becomes free inside, but not necessarily divorced from nature. Sri Aurobindo will offer a solution to that, that getting to the interior reaches of the being where then you discover that you are not that, essentially, permits you to rise to a different status of relationship with the dynamic power of existence and to call that into being. So that then the consciousness is never falsely associated, imperfectly associated with a form, but instead always knows that it's a flow from a divine energy. So he will move the idea of Purusha and Prakriti away from the simple freedom that one gets by realizing the Purusha consciousness and towards the fusion of that consciousness with the energy, so that when one becomes Lord and not simply witness, one becomes Ishvara. Prakriti no longer maintains her disguise in the lower form as Prakriti, externalizing nature, but instead becomes Shakti, the energy of the divine consciousness. This idea, though, of a dualism, Purusha and Prakriti, has stuck with the discussion for thousands of years now. Sri Aurobindo has to take up the vocabulary and deal with it and accept it, even though it's uncomfortable. He is an integralist. He is looking for a way to unify spirit and nature, to say that nature is the action of the spirit, or can be directly so and not simply hidden, that the Supreme can stand out in what seems to us as evanescent and finite. So let's take up then this next section. When the sadhaka has once stood back from the action of Prakriti within him or upon him, and not interfering, not amending or inhibiting, not choosing or deciding, allowed its play and analyzed and watched the process, he soon discovers that her modes are self-dependent and work as a machine once put in action works by its own structure and propelling forces. So when you stand back and get a little distance, you see that once it starts, it carries on with its own momentum. Nature plays. You gave consent, and now the play has begun, and will carry itself forward. The force and the propulsion come from Prakriti and not from the creature. We think we're the authors of things, but actually it's the general action of nature. Then he realizes how mistaken was his impression that his mind was the doer of his works. His mind was only a small part of him and a creation, an engine of nature. Nature was acting all the while in her own modes, moving the three general qualities about as a girl might play with her puppets. His ego was all along a tool and plaything. His character and intelligence, his moral qualities and mental powers, his creations and works and exploits, his anger and forbearance, his cruelty and mercy, his love and his hatred, his sin and his virtue, his light and his darkness, his passion of joy and his anguish of sorrow, were the play of nature to which the soul attracted, won and subjected, lent its passive concurrence. And yet, the determinism of nature or force is not all. The soul has a word to say in the matter, but the secret soul, the Purusha, not the mind or the ego. Since these are not independent entities, they are parts of nature. Back to the structure we describe. Ahamkara is an evolute of Prakriti. For the soul's sanction is needed for the play, and by an inner silent will as the Lord and giver of the sanction, it can determine the principle of the play and intervene in its combinations, although the execution in thought and will and act and impulse must still be nature's part and privilege. So the soul can rather lean into the machinery of the personal structure, but still the action is being done by the elements of Prakriti. The Purusha can dictate a harmony for nature to execute, not by interfering in her functions, but by a conscious regard on her, which she transmutes at once or after much difficulty into translating idea and dynamic impetus and significant figure. So he suggests that a will is implicit in the very vision, the very sight that the Purusha possesses, and that is not born of Prakriti. That is transmitted through Prakriti. So how? It must be from the most reflective, the most luminous part of Prakriti, through the buddhi, through the intelligent will that the intent of the Purusha can manifest. So if there can be an intent in the Purusha, then is not the sheer blank consciousness that classical Sankhya portrays, it is instinct with power. It is instinct with a will force. It is capable of variable action. It can choose amongst things. They are not impersonal to it. They are not indifferent to it. It can choose. An escape from the action of the two inferior gunas is very evidently indispensable if we are to transmute our present nature into a power and form of the divine consciousness and an instrument of its forces. So the question is not only can we stand back from it and be free and lean into nature in some creative way, he says we can, but first we have to get free from the old nature. How do we do that? Tamas obscures and prevents the light of the divine knowledge from penetrating into the dark and dull corners of our nature. Tamas incapacitates and takes away the power to respond to divine impulse and the energy to change and the will to progress and make ourselves plastic to a greater Shakti. Rajas perverts knowledge, makes our reason the accomplice of falsehood and the abettor of every wrong movement, disturbs and twists our life force and its impulses, oversets the balance and health of the body. Rajas captures all high-born ideas and high-seated movements and turns them to a false and egoistic use. Even divine truth and divine influences, when they descend into the earthly plane, cannot escape this misuse and seizure. Tamas, unenlightened, and Rajas, unconverted, no divine change or divine life is possible. So, let's continue. An exclusive resort to sattva would seem to be the way of escape. But there is this difficulty, that no one of the qualities can prevail by itself against its two companions and rivals. So we're caught in the mesh of nature, and nature cannot free itself or from its own forms. In other words, either cosmically or even working in the particular. However finely you attune, however much you harmonize, always all three gunas will be there. But he's already said that as long as Rajas is present, as long as Tamas is present, the divine life is not possible. So he must be looking for something else, and sattva, he says, is not going to be able to deliver that. If, envisaging the quality of desire and passion as the cause of disturbance, suffering, sin, and sorrow, we strain and labor to quell and subdue it, Rajas sinks, but Tamas rises. For the principle of activity dulled, inertia takes its place. A quiet peace, happiness, knowledge, love, right sentiment can be founded by the principle of light, but if Rajas is absent or completely suppressed, the quiet in the soul tends to become a tranquility of inaction, not the firm ground of a dynamic change. Ineffectively, right thinking, right doing, good, mild, and even, the nature may become in its dynamic parts sattva, tamasic, neutral, pale-tinted, uncreative, or emptied of power. Mental and moral obscurity may be absent, but so are the intense springs of action. And this is a hampering limitation and another kind of incompetence. For tamas is a double principle. It contradicts rajas by inertia. It contradicts sattva by narrowness, obscurity, and ignorance. And if either is depressed, it pours in to occupy its place. Tamas rises, darkness rises. If we call in rajas again to correct this error and bid it ally itself to sattva, and by their united agency endeavor to get rid of the dark principle, we find that we have elevated our action, but that there is again subjection to rajasic eagerness, passion, disappointment, suffering, anger. These movements may be more exalted in their scope and spirit and action than before, but they are not the peace, the freedom, the power, the self-mastery at which we long to arrive. Wherever desire and ego harbor, passion and disturbance harbor with them and share their life. And if we seek a compromise between the three modes, sattva leading, the others subordinate, still, we have only arrived at a more temperate action of the play of nature. A new poise has been reached. But a spiritual freedom and mastery are not in sight, or else are still only a far-off prospect. This is the sattvic compromise, which will make you very good, make you an extraordinarily fine person, but will not divinize you. Will make you morally excellent, but will not make you divine. A radically different movement has to draw us back from the gunas and lift us above them. The error that accepts the action of the modes of nature must cease. For as long as it is accepted, the soul is involved in their operations and subjected to their law. Sattva must be transcended, as well as rajas and tamas. The golden chain must be broken no less than the leaden fetters and the bond ornaments of a mixed alloy. The Gita prescribes to this end a new method of self-discipline. It is to stand back in oneself from the action of the modes and observe this unsteady flux as the witness seated above the surge of the forces of nature. Gita, chapter 2, shloka 48. He is one who watches, but is impartial and indifferent, aloof from them on their own level and in his native posture, high above them. Udasinata, seated above, looking down upon nature. As they rise and fall in their waves, the witness looks, observes, but neither accepts nor for the moment interferes with their course. First, there must be the freedom of the impersonal witness. Afterwards, there can be the control of the master, the Ishwara. And of course, that's the eighth chapter in the Gita. So there's another triangle of asterisks. So we'll pause and pick that up next time. So this is a section, a short section from Savitri, Book 1, the Book of Beginnings. Canto 3, The Yoga of the Soul's Release. Thus came his soul's release from ignorance. His mind and body's first spiritual change. A wide God knowledge poured down from above. A new world knowledge broadened from within. His daily thoughts looked up to the true and one. His commonest doings welled from an inner light. Awakened to the lines that nature hides, attuned to her movements that exceed our ken, he grew one with a covert universe. His grasp surprised her mightiest energy's springs. He spoke with the unknown guardians of the worlds. Forms he descried, our mortal eyes see not. His wide eyes bodied viewless entities. He saw the cosmic forces at their work and felt the occult impulse behind man's will. Time's secrets were to him an oft-read book. The records of the future and the past outlined their excerpts on the etheric page. One and harmonious by the Maker's skill, the human in him paced with the divine. His acts betrayed not the interior flame. This forged the greatness of his front to earth. A genius heightened in his body's cells that knew the meaning of his fate-hedged works, akin to the march of unaccomplished powers beyond life's arc in spirit's immensities. Apart, he lived in his mind's solitude. A demigod shaping the lives of men. One soul's ambition lifted up the race. A power worked, but none knew whence it came. The universal strengths were linked with his, filling Earth's smallness with their boundless breaths. He drew the energies that transmute an age. Immeasurable by the common look, he made great dreams a mold for coming things and cast his deeds like bronze to front the years. His walk through time outstripped the human stride. Lonely his days, and splendid like the sun's. Yes. Namaste, Jai Ma.